from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. President Trump today is seizing on a shorter-than-expected sentence for his former campaign chairman as support for his claim that there was, quote, no collusion with Russia. A federal judge yesterday gave Paul Manafort less than 4 years in prison for tax fraud and bank fraud. He was not before the Virginia court for anything having to do with Russia. Sentencing guidelines were for 19 to 24 years. Manafort's attorneys had asked for a lighter sentence given his age of nearly 70 and health problems. And when Manafort appeared yesterday in a wheelchair in prison jumpsuit, he said that the past 2 years have been the hardest of his life and that, quote, to say I feel humiliated and ashamed would be an understatement. Joining me now is Laura Bazelon. She's a professor at USF School of Law and author of The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. Good morning, Laura Bazelon.
Good morning.
We're also joined by Darren Samuelson. He's a senior reporter for Politico. Good morning, Darren Samuelson.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, Laura Bazelon, I'll start with you first. What is your reaction to the sentence?
My reaction was that my jaw dropped slightly because 47 months is a dramatic departure from the range of 19 to 24 years. So if you think about it and break down the math, what it means is that he gets 9 months credit for the time he spent in jail pending the trial and through trial, and then he gets credit for a good time. So it boils down to a sentence of about 31 months for a massive fraud that consumed tens of millions of dollars. And for most defendants facing that range, they land nowhere near that light an outcome.
And just to remind listeners, he was charged with 2 counts of bank fraud, 5 counts of tax fraud, and 1 count of failing to declare a foreign bank account. Darren Samuelson, were you in the courtroom yesterday, or you were definitely watching the proceedings carefully?
I was in the courtroom, yeah. I was there for the entire trial back last summer for 3.5 long weeks in Alexandria, Virginia, and then, yes, was in the courtroom yesterday for the sentencing.
And what were some of the arguments that Manafort's attorneys and Manafort was making, which would lead to a reduced sentence?
So they were trying to make the case that Mr. Manafort, one, is in not the best of health, and he needs to be in a much better situation than the solitary confinement that he has been in for the last 9 months. So that was one argument. They were also making the argument that while tax fraud, I believe they said, is not jaywalking, it's also not narcotics trafficking. And so they were trying to make the point that this is a white-collar crime. If you looked at some of the other cases, a judge, T.S. Ellis III, the judge there in Virginia who has been presiding over the case, he's a Reagan appointee. He had previously given other people who had committed some of these crimes, even at even larger scales and with more tax fraud and more bank fraud, had gotten lesser sentences. There were some differences between those cases and Mr. Manafort's cases. There are in all of these cases. Another argument they were making is, look, this was a case brought only because of the Russia probe that Special Counsel Robert Mueller, pursued Paul Manafort for these crimes only because he was Donald Trump's campaign chairman. And that this case wouldn't have, seen the attention, obviously, that it got had Paul Manafort not been who he was. And they pushed all of that on Judge Ellis, who, throughout the trial back last summer and again yesterday, made it pretty clear that he was not necessarily thrilled with Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the appointment. He had upheld his ability to be the prosecutor looking into, the wider Russia collusion questions, because that had actually been put forward by Manafort earlier on in the case. And the judge had ultimately sided and said, yes, Mr. Mueller could continue to prosecute this case. But he you could clearly tell that he had some disfavor with the special counsel, and that came through yesterday during the hearing.
And Laura Bazelon, do you think that played a role in the shorter-than-expected sentence, or do you buy what Judge Ellis was saying, was that this is generally how he goes with similar white-collar crimes?
I unquestionably think that it did play a role, because you saw throughout the trial Judge T.S. Ellis expressing skepticism, with the special counsel expressing skepticism directly to the prosecutors. And the first words essentially out of his mouth were, there is no evidence that Paul Manafort colluded with Russia, and kind of setting the tone for, we're here on essentially a garden variety fraud case. And throughout, he made it clear that he believed that the special counsel was using Paul Manafort to try to pry open more evidence against Donald Trump and some of his other associates. And so it's pretty clear to me that that was not just in the water in terms of what was put out there by the defense attorneys quite effectively throughout this trial, but it was also something, an argument that really got to Judge Ellis's head and influenced him.
Well, can you just give us a sense of how closely judges adhere to sentencing guidelines generally, or what they're required to do?
So until 1987, there were no sentencing guidelines. They were put into place with this idea that they were going to sort of standardize the way that people were getting punished. And if you look at them, they're a grid. On the x-axis is your criminal history, what you've done in the past. And on the y-axis is your offense, and then things that either exacerbate that offense, make it more serious, or perhaps make it less serious. And then it's supposed to bring you to a place on the grid that is a range of months or years. So in Paul Manafort's case, when you connect those dots, you get 19 to 24 years. Now, until about 2004, those guidelines were essentially considered to be mandatory, and judges had to really follow whatever range was in that box unless they could show compelling evidence for going up or down. But then the Supreme Court decided a case called Booker in which they said, no, these guidelines are actually not mandatory. They are advisory. And at that point, the shackles came off, and judges to some degree have reverted back to their pre-1987 practices of using an enormous amount of discretion. And so while they'll give voice to the guidelines, essentially they can do whatever they want as long as it doesn't exceed the statutory maximum, so long as they supply sufficient justification for it. And so in answer to your question, there are judges like Judge Ellis who really don't agree with the guidelines in certain cases, in white-collar cases. Think, for example, they're too harsh and will fairly routinely depart downward or vary from them.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join the conversation. We're getting reaction to the sentence handed down to Paul Manafort yesterday, President Trump's former campaign chairman, of less than 4 years in prison for bank and tax fraud when sentencing guidelines recommended 19 to 24 years. We're talking with Laura Bazelon, a professor at USF's School of Law, and Darren Samuelson, a senior reporter for Politico. What are your questions for them? What's your opinion of the sentence? What message do you think it sends? Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us or post your comments on Facebook. Priscilla says, perhaps I shouldn't have given so much credence to the news pundit saying before sentencing that he was facing up to 20 years. 47 months, Manafort probably will not have to serve even that long. That's something that you made clear earlier, Laura Bazelon. So, Darren Samuelson, this point about the short sentence suggesting that there was no collusion between the president's campaign and Russia. Can you talk a little bit about how the president is interpreting and messaging the sentence, Darren Samuelson?
Sure. I mean, he's saying the same thing he's been saying for a long time now. And I mean, it's interesting to note that the case that happened in Virginia purposely was never about the Russia collusion questions. And Judge Ellis himself, at the very beginning of that trial, outlawed anyone from, I think, using the words Russia over and over again. He was upset with the use of the word oligarch. He was upset with all of these terms that he thought would bias the jury that, you know, had obviously been consumed with the story of the Mueller probe. And so for the president today, you know, to say, aha, you know, this is a exoneration on this point, it's definitely a little bit misleading, given that, again, the case itself wasn't about that and never was about that. Now, clearly, as you pointed out, the point for the conviction where it was, you know, Manafort was convicted last summer, and then ultimately he was supposed to face another trial in Washington, D.C. on separate charges. And this is an important point to note as we're talking about the sentencing, is Paul Manafort actually will be sentenced again on Wednesday in Washington, D.C. on these other charges that he pled guilty to. And he's looking at another 10 years maximum that will come down from Judge Amy Berman Jackson in Washington, D.C. And so, you know, we're talking about a 14-year sentence at that point if he got the maximum in court in Washington. But, you know, and even in that case, the questions of Russian collusion was never really a part of the case. Now, clearly, while they did net a guilty plea out of him, that led to cooperation, which was required as part of that with Mr. Manafort and the special counsel. And they spent, I think it was 12 sessions together with Mr. Manafort, you know, pumping him for anything and everything that they wanted to ask him, which was part of the plea deal. And then they turned around and actually accused him of lying to them during those pro-offer sessions and then during the interviews. And then they actually brought him before the grand jury twice. And it was in the course of that that Manafort lied on a number of items accused by Mueller. And then ultimately that Judge Jackson about 3 weeks ago, sided with Mueller on a couple of the issues and said, yes, Mr. Manafort did lie. And so that really just kind of undercuts Manafort's, case now as he goes before this other judge. And really just kind of it's added to this swirl of disinformation and confusion about where things stand right now in this investigation where, and again, Manafort was supposed to be a cooperator. But it looks like, he was just kind of, treading water there. And as we saw from his attorneys yesterday as they left the courthouse in Virginia, they're clearly playing right now for a pardon from President Trump, which is maybe the next shoe to fall after the sentencing next week in Washington.
Yes. Well, you brought up a lot of things, Darren Samuelson. But just going back to the sentencing in the D.C. case, as you said, the judge agreed with prosecutors that Manafort had lied to them. And right now, the judge will determine whether or not that, what to sentence Manafort to. As you said, he faces a maximum of 10 years. And whether or not he can serve that sentence concurrent with the one that he received yesterday, or whether or not it would be consecutive. Laura Bazelon, do judges consider, the fact that he was handed what some consider a much lighter sentence than sentencing guidelines recommended in determining their own sentences?
Well, they're really not supposed to. What the question for Judge Amy Berman Jackson is, what is the correct punishment given what Paul Manafort has pleaded guilty to? And that is two counts of conspiracy. And as you say, he's on the hook potentially to get a maximum of 10 years, which is 5 years on each count stacked, which means running consecutively. But here are a couple of crucial differences between the two cases. In front of Judge Berman Jackson, not only did she agree with the prosecutors that Paul Manafort, rather than cooperate, had lied, which is a huge no-no and deprives him of the ability to ask for leniency under what's called 5K1.1, which is the substantial assistance provision of the federal sentencing guidelines. But on top of that, she put him in jail for witness tampering while the case was pending. And right. So she now knows him to be a thoroughly bad actor. It isn't simply that he's pleading guilty to these two counts. It's also that he lied to prosecutors and witness tampered. And I think that all is going to play a role in the ultimate sentence that she hands down. And I think those who were disappointed perhaps in what we might consider to be a quite lenient sentence handed down by Judge Ellis might see from Judge Berman Jackson a more severe sanction based on everything that I just said.
Well, let's hear from John in Pacifica. Hi, John.
Yes, I want to ask the USF professor what kind of sentences the hundreds of criminals in the subprime mortgage crisis should have gotten. Only one person went to federal prison, according to Jesse Eisinger's book, The Chicken Something Club. Robert Mueller was head of the FBI from 2001 to 2013. James Comey was head of the FBI from 2013 to 2017. And only one person in the big banks on Wall Street went to prison. What kind of sentences should have those hundreds of criminals gone to jail? In fact, Elizabeth Warren was here in San Francisco talking about her book in 2014, and she wondered why Barack Obama, Eric Holder, and Manny Brewer put no one in prison.
John, thank you. And yes, Elizabeth Warren had strong words for yesterday's sentence. And also, Laura Bazelon, along the same lines as John's comment, this listener writes, I'm surprised that anyone is surprised by this outcome. White-collar criminals do not get punished the same way as the rest of us. If your white-collar crime results in death, suicide, suffering, it does not matter. Some guy robbing the 7-Eleven, though, he needs to be punished to the maximum.
Yes, and I think that dovetails that question with the listener's comment, and it plays into this public perception, and I think it is a correct one, that when you commit white-collar crimes, one, you're much less likely to be indicted, much less go to prison, and two, even if you plead guilty or are found guilty and don't apologize, we had no apology from Paul Manafort, and behave really terribly, you will get a lenient punishment. And it sends, I think, a pretty toxic message that the criminal justice system has two standards. One for powerful people of some wealth who abuse that power, whether it's defrauding homeowners or defrauding taxpayers, and that they can expect to be treated with some degree of leniency. And then there's another standard for everyone else. So, for example, my clients, when I was a deputy federal public defender, who were charged with all kinds of things but didn't have any money and more often people of color, were punished extremely harshly and would never be so lucky as to get the kind of sentence that Paul Manafort got. And I do think, to be quite honest, it was a grave mistake by the Justice Department under Obama not to go after some of these individuals, some of these bad actors. And in certain ways, it led to the kind of populist rage that has landed us where we are here today.
But typically, as federal public defender, you wouldn't support long sentences, even though you are, I guess, advocating for a longer sentence for Manafort? Or are you advocating just for more parity in sentencing generally?
I'm opposed, generally speaking, to long sentences. I believe what they result in is mass incarceration and high levels of recidivism. And that's my background and training and worldview. But that said, if they exist in our system, then we need to apply them fairly. And so I think my point with Paul Manafort is that this was not a just outcome under the regime that we have. Now, you could argue that we need a different regime, but we have the one that we have. And I don't believe in this case the outcome, from my personal point of view, was fair or appropriate.
Well, let's go next to Lisimba in Oakland. Hi, Lisimba.
Hi. It's kind of piggybacking on everything we're talking about right now. It's quite frustrating to hear everybody talk about white collar crimes almost with like an air of nonchalance and, oh, you know, if it's done within the business, if it's done by somebody in a button up shirt and a tie, then let's take it easy on them. Or if someone with a hoodie or, you know, baggy pants or someone on the street corner gets taken up, that we need to make an example of them. And it seems like this narrative just keeps playing over and over again, and yet people say, I don't see the discrepancy. And I'm wondering, you know, when it comes to these judges that are in power to make these decisions and ultimately set the pace of how the law is being applied, you know, what kind of power or influence or, you know, what can we do to really, you know, have justice be served in a light that is equal? I mean, what can we do to bring about real change and inequality in this nation?
Well, Laura Bazelon, I feel like I have to go back to you again to respond to Lisimba.
Sure. Well, the short answer to that question is that you can't do anything directly, and that is because judges like Judge Ellis and Judge Berman Jackson are federal judges. They are appointed by the president, and they are confirmed by the Senate for life, unless they commit such bad misconduct that they can be impeached, which almost never happens. But here's the way that you can affect change. You can decide who gets to be in the White House and who gets to make these appointments, and it matters very much. It's an issue that a lot of liberal voters overlook, I think to their detriment, and conservatives focus on quite wisely. They focus on electing people who are going to appoint the kind of judges that they want. And I think if people want to see justice done in the way that justice personally means to them, it's important to elect someone who's in the position to appoint those folks who reflects your values.
And that was certainly a point on social media about how this illustrates, especially for those who are unhappy with the sentence, how much elections matter. Anita writes, isn't there also a financial aspect to his punishment? If he were to receive a pardon, would he still have to pay those fines and restitution, or is that at least untouchable? Darren Samuelson, he was ordered to pay nearly $25 million in restitution as well as a $50,000 fine. Can you talk about that financial aspect of his punishment and then also how that would play related to a pardon?
Well, on the second part, the pardon wouldn't really save him the financial payback that he needs to make. So there's, I think, $6 million in tax back taxes that he hasn't paid on all of the foreign bank accounts that he had spread across multiple places that was proven during the trial. He will still have to make those restitutions, even if there was a pardon. He's also supposed to pay back the banks and, I believe, a number of other individuals and associates and organizations that he owes money to, as well as that fine. So, yeah, he would not be saved by a pardon whenever and if a pardon ever comes. No doubt there's a political calculation that President Trump would need to make if he does issue a pardon. And when would he issue a pardon? Would it be, you know, before this election season is over or after? Same thing with that fine. So that's hanging out there. And then, of course, there are states investigating Paul Manafort and sort of waiting in the wings in the event of a pardon. We saw, I think, the Manhattan District Attorney indicating that some of the same charges that Mr. Manafort faced in Virginia could be brought again if a pardon was issued. So that's kind of where things stand on that front. There was a lot of haggling yesterday over whether Mr. Manafort should be given sort of a set number for how much he should pay back versus actually first letting him sell many of his properties. He has condos and homes in New York, Florida, Virginia. And it sounds like he is going to be selling, I think, every property, but maybe it's something like two in Palm Beach Gardens and Florida, and one of his homes in Virginia. And he's going to – the prosecutors made the point yesterday that he has, I think it was like $4 to $5 million in equity in those two homes, and that will be what they'll expect to be tapped into for the fine that he was ordered to pay.
Laura Bazelon, more on this question of pardons. I mean, what are the criteria for a presidential pardon? Couldn't the case be made that if the president attempts to pardon Paul Manafort, that he would basically be doing that so that, you know, he could stop others, say, from speaking or cooperating with prosecutors?
I think it's a very tough argument to make. The presidential power to pardon is virtually unchecked. And the only real argument that could be made against Donald Trump is that by pardoning Paul Manafort, he was somehow trying to obstruct justice and so acting with a corrupt intent. But of course, the problem with that is that Paul Manafort, as was pointed out earlier, wasn't convicted of any crimes relating to collusion, relating to Russia, relating to interference with the election. He was convicted of massive frauds, but they were of the garden variety type that had to do with his business, how he conducted his business. And so I think it would be a very hard sell to say that Donald Trump was abusing the pardon power if he exercised it to pardon Manafort, because it is so difficult to make that case.
Well, Mark writes, is this more about a spotlight indicating that white-collar crime is less consequential than other violations? Kevin writes, if Manafort was poor or of color, I firmly believe that he would have gotten 10 years. I don't even care about the Trump factor. I'm just mad at the incredible difference between the legal treatment of the poor and the rich and whites and people of color. Darren Samuelson, what message do you think this sentence sends? Clearly, it sends a message on the level of criminal justice and the way that, punishment is meted out on certain people for certain types of crimes. But the other side of this is that this is, you know, the only case brought to trial by the Office of Justice by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, right? That he has, indicted 30 plus individuals, that there will be more hearings, more sentences down the line. I mean, what does this say about what we could expect down the line, if anything?
Well, I mean, this was obviously one narrow case in Virginia being decided by a judge who made the point yesterday, while he made this point after he issued the sentence and trying to anticipate the blowback that he was going to get by saying, 47 months, while it doesn't seem like a lot, he recommends anybody who's, criticizing him to go spend a day in a federal penitentiary, and they'll know, that it's no, cakewalk. So that was the argument that Judge Ellis made yesterday. And obviously, Manafort has been in solitary confinement for the last 9 months, really on his own. It's just for his own safety. He is in the jail that he is in because he had actually requested that from the court, which granted him the right to move to the jail that he has been sitting in Alexandria, Virginia, close to the courthouse. As for, future cases down the line, I mean, it's hard to say who might still go to trial in Special Counsel Mueller's case investigation. We do know Roger Stone, the longtime Trump associate, who was indicted for lying to Congress and witness tampering, is fighting that case, and that is the only one that really at this point seems headed for a trial. We're actually going to learn next week. I think it's Thursday here in Washington before Judge Amy Berman Jackson, who on Wednesday will be sentencing Paul Manafort. The next day, she will be holding a status hearing for Roger Stone, and we will learn a trial date, which is likely to be later this summer, early fall. And Roger Stone, like Paul Manafort, who actually is his former business partner, way back in the day, they were lobbying partners together in the 80s here in Washington, is fighting that case. And he actually could find himself being sent to jail, too, under a gag order. He's been under a gag order for a couple of weeks now, and he has continued to make noise on Instagram, commenting to reporters, There's been a couple of other instances. He's got a book coming out, which is what she's really upset about right now. And so it's possible, like Paul Manafort, who got sent to jail before his trial, Roger Stone could end up in jail by this time next week, based on the gag order violations that Special Counsel Mueller has pointed out. You know, there could be more cases still to come from Mueller. I'll say that. You know, people are saying that this investigation is about to wrap up. I don't believe that quite to be the case. There's still plenty of outstanding things still out there. And so it's very possible more charges could be brought. And if not from Mueller, it's possible from the Southern District of New York, which is a very expansive investigative unit that we know is investigating Donald Trump's inauguration, his transition, his campaign for all the things that Michael Cohen has copped to in his guilty plea. So there's a lot of other things sort of hanging out there in possible future cases. And of course, that's not to mention even the House of Representatives and the possibility of impeaching President Trump, which is very much in play. And that gets back to the pardon question that we were talking about before, as well as many other things.
Well, speaking of the pardon question, I'm curious, Darren Samuelson, if you have any sense of what the reaction would be on Capitol Hill if the president does pardon Paul Manafort, or how Republican lawmakers are responding to the sentence.
Well, I think Democrats would uniformly criticize that move through and through. We had a piece of legislation introduced yesterday by the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, from your neck of the woods, that would go after the pardon question. And, you know, I think there would clearly be condemnation if there was an impeachment proceeding. That would probably be one of the articles of impeachment, would be, you know, something on obstruction of justice and the president's pardon, which I think is why maybe you're not going to see a pardon from President Trump on Paul Manafort or any of the other people for some time to come. I'm talking to people today on the topic who think maybe he will, you know, line them up and start issuing them and just try and ignite politically the Democrats to come after him. There is a political calculation here that Donald Trump's world believes that, you know, if he was to be impeached, that would actually backfire on the Democrats and help Trump be reelected in November of 2020 and, you know, on a sympathy vote in the same way that the impeachment of Bill Clinton backfired on him. So there is, you know, a calculation maybe that they will make and decide to do pardons sooner than later. You know, understanding as well that that could open him up to impeachment. As for the Republicans, that is the, you know, that is the million-dollar question, whether any Republicans would step forward and really at any sizable number condemn President Trump for this. I think this goes back to Robert Mueller's larger investigation and whether there's smoking guns still in there that haven't come out yet. And, you know, I think that's what Republicans are watching for, is any wider, you know, lessons to be learned from the Mueller probe that would be impeachable offenses that would actually turn Republicans around. But right now, no, the Republicans have been very much walking in lockstep with the president, but for, you know, a couple small exceptions.
Well, Darren Samuelson, senior reporter for Politico, thanks for talking with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And Laura Bazelon, professor of USF School of Law and author of The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. Thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Mina Kim. Thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. Another Hour of Forum is next. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.